Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Joseph.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today, we're going to do something strange. I normally pretty much talk about whatever I want, not having any particular relevance to the issue today, although I do make exceptions for that on occasion. But there's a lot been going on. Here we are coming to the end of July 2016, and my fear is that the press, media in general, filter information such that they decide what's important. They decide what issues we should be worried about and what not to be worried about. And within those issues, what the acceptable parameters of a civilized opinion might be on these things. And outside of those parameters, you are extremist, possibly dangerous, and should be watched. Although that usually goes just for the right. That does not apply to the left. At least so long as the left continues to support internationalism. That kind of violence is fully acceptable. Now, the issues that have been thrown at us here in these soundbite kind of ways by the systems of media are, of course, the two conventions where nothing of any significance is stated and nothing really is done. It's pure pageantry and very expensive pageantry. I can't help but laugh at the fact that the Democratic National Convention has a wall built around it to protect it from intruders from the outside, while they condemn, of course, Donald Trump's idea of a wall. Let's be very clear before we get too far off track here. Concerning the election, one quick thing. When Donald Trump announced his candidacy and when he said that his big issue was going to be immigration, at least at first, his companies doing business with him, companies like American Express and Sears and some of these, they were the first to divest in him, wanted nothing to do with him. Before anyone had any idea of what was going to happen with Donald Trump, what occurred was it was corporate America that went after him. Long before there were anything in the streets, long before there was any violence or threats, corporate America en masse defected from Donald Trump. They condemned him right away, rendering him really, at least from the media's point of view, just a joke. They didn't count on him financing his own campaign. I think part of the mentality was that he couldn't rely on anybody. So it was corporate America that led the attack on him. And not these organizations in the streets. Corporate America finances them anyway. Their big concern is that so much of their income in America comes from cheap labor from abroad. So much of their leverage to use against higher wage workers, especially white workers, comes from bringing in both low-level and high-level immigrants from abroad, from Mexico, from India, from China, who have India and China, who have high levels of education and yet will work for less money. It's far more than just cheap labor. It's also a means to divide people, to bring people in that no one trusts, to create animosity, sometimes artificially, and to give the impression that any complaint, any demand for higher wages, any demand for better working conditions will lead to simply more foreigners coming in, or worst case scenario, they simply divest of in the United States and they move abroad. That's really what the issue was. Donald Trump hit on an issue that is so essential to corporate America, cheap labor, the use of non-whites to create division, to destroy any sense of unity in the working class, and to repress wages everywhere. This is what Donald Trump threatened when he began talking about building this wall, whether literally or metaphorically. That was the main concern and the only concern that corporate America had. Anyway, that's all I'm going to say about that for right now. The concern I have is that these are all largely artificial issues. Not necessarily what I just said, but I'm saying in general, issues of the election, things like plagiarizing a speech, the cost of the dresses that the women wear, All the accusations, they're accusing Donald Trump now of having raped somebody many years ago. They will say anything, they will do anything to discredit him. Issues concerning the sudden interest in a third party, where the regime suddenly have noticed the Libertarian Party trying to make sure that Donald Trump doesn't get elected. And something to do with this Japanese game called Pokemon that has got Americans obsessed. Maybe not my listeners. Really, if you're obsessed with this thing, I want you to turn the radio off and just, you know, stop listening to me, because I'm insulted that someone like you would actually pretend to understand what I'm saying. I'm being into that kind of garbage. These are the things that, you know, Americans are easy to control. They do something like this, and whatever the truth of these kind of, you know, the software that's spying on people, it really doesn't matter. What is the point of spying on people if they are so easily distracted, so easily obsessed with this kind of thing? What is the point of spying on them? I say the same thing to people on the right wing. They talk about how their enemies are federal agents. And I know I've said this before, and I'll say it again. You laugh at them and you say, number one, you're not that important. Number two, why? Why are they going to spend the money to try to harm something that can't get three people to agree and do anything? So usually, you know, most of the right is not worth infiltrating. So the issues involved here today are largely artificial ones. These ridiculous party organization meetings in one in Philadelphia, the other in Cleveland, nothing of substance is discussed. Nothing too complicated. Nothing with more than three syllables, and certainly nothing, you know, the fact that now the big issue, which is, although being reported, is certainly not headline news, is that the United States is threatening military action openly and loudly against both Russia and China at the same time. American troops are in Poland, in the Baltics, right on the Russian border, in aggressive combat stance. China has already threatened the American Navy in the South China Sea, and this is going to get worse. My personal opinion is that this is the system's last gamble. The economy is unrecoverable. The debt is unrepayable. There is simply nowhere for anyone to go. There's too much production. There is so much debt. No more credit can be extended. And so this overproduction is going to go nowhere. And what the regime is looking at is hyperinflation, collapse, the complete and absolute delegitimation of their sick system. Now, of course, that's a great thing. But the regime, these people didn't get to their positions of power by being idiots. And they certainly didn't get there by refusing to take risks. One of the things, not the only thing, but one of the things that motivated FDR in the early 40s, was that there's nothing like a war to resurrect an economy that refused to get going again. Somehow, the executive branch decided that it has the right, constitutionally, to take over the entire economy. And to do this, FDR ended up packing the Supreme Court, simply adding more members, because, you know, the Constitution doesn't specify how many members you have to have for the Supreme Court. Complete subversion of anything remotely approaching the rule of law, and no outrage at all, plus the fact FDR was also hounding his opponents. His political opponents were being rounded up. He failed to do that, to persecute them as far as he wanted to, but he certainly attempted it. And of course, today he is seen as a great progressive, because these things are considered progressive. The total war economy is that the state simply takes over all production. Every major capital organization in the United States was taken over by the federal government and ordered to begin producing for war. Now, I'm sure there's all kinds of bureaucratic mechanisms that went into doing this, which I have no interest in studying. What any fool knows is, of course, the federal government had no right to take over anything. The broader point is, in doing this, in creating this huge demand all of a sudden for labor, where millions of workers and consumers were sent overseas. It became wards of the government in the draft and in the military and all the support system. The Depression was over. The Depression was over, and the 1950s and early 60s resulted in a great degree of prosperity for at least most Americans. Now, a lot of that prosperity was bought on credit, so it was all false. But that was a massive gamble on the part of FDR. I don't think anyone seriously doubts that FDR was absolutely obsessed with starting a war with Japan, a country that did not threaten the U.S., and deliberately sending the Japanese ambassador home, knowing full well that his government will fall and the militarists will rise as a result. No one questions that anymore. He brought war on to get himself out of the Depression. The regime is not above doing that now. There's a big difference, though. The U.S. has no money, has no legitimacy, has no social unity, doesn't have the manpower, doesn't have any real reason to fight here. It will lose any confrontation with Russia or China separately, let alone the two together. It will also mean, of course, the U.S. will have to fight Kazakhstan, one of the world's largest countries, and very strategic, actually all of Central Asia, North Korea, Venezuela, Iran, Armenia, I know very small, but very strategic. I believe pro-Western governments in Eastern Europe will fall immediately. Most of the world will line up behind Russia and China. And I believe the only two countries that the U.S. could count on temporarily would be Japan and Britain. But once the bodies start coming home in large numbers, the question might present itself to why are we fighting? I don't believe that it is somehow above, or I should say below the system to deliberately provoke Russia and China individually or both together in a major world war. I firmly believe that the elite of the regime know that the game is over. Everything in this, you know, the last 50 years have been built on debt. No more can be extended. It's at such absurd levels now that no economy can function with this level of false overvaluation. The U.S. dollar has lost most of its value over the last 100 years. The game is over. And for no clear reason, I mean, I can't, if this isn't the reason why the U.S. is deliberately goading both Russia and China, neither country threatens the U.S. Neither country has any interest in an open, massive war with the United States. I'd like to hear if there's another explanation. I haven't come across it yet. I think we're looking at something similar to the U.S. in 1940. The U.S. was much stronger back then, much more unified back then. I firmly believe that the American military, when faced with regulars, not ragtag guerrillas, but regular forces trained and prepared to deal with the U.S., they will be defeated. They'll be defeated handily. Partially because they're not really used to an enemy that can fight back, and partially because the Americans have nothing to fight for. What is the U.S. doing this part of the world? Why is it of interest to the U.S. that Americans die in defense of some abstract value in the South China Sea? There's absolutely none. And the era of simply sending guys over there with no sense of where they're going, that's over. That was the case many years ago. The manpower is not there. The money is not there. The strength of will is not there. The legitimacy is not there. The social unity is not there. All of these are absolutely essential for a war to be fought, let alone won. Now, with all of this going on, there was one news story that caught my eye, buried. Something like Michael Hoffman used to say, you kind of catch it in the corner of your eye. And the story, the headline basically says, Slobodan Milosevic has been exonerated. He has been found innocent of all war crimes that in the 1990s, as you know, he was called the next Hitler, the butcher of Belgrade, all these ridiculous things. He has been completely exonerated. Now, there seems to be a pattern Saddam Hussein did not have weapons of mass destruction. Of course, the question is, well, so what if he did? Israel certainly does. So then Iraq certainly can. China, whose Communist Party killed far more people than any other institution in the history of the world, had nuclear weapons since 1964. And no one really got out, bent out of shape about that. So what if he had weapons of mass destruction? But even if that is somehow a justifiable reason to go to war, guaranteeing that he would use those weapons, of course, makes no sense. He didn't have it. Neither did anybody in that part of the world. The pattern is that the regime's media will begin planting stories, will lie, will make stuff up, will print, you know, Pentagon or oil company press releases as news. They'll tell stories about guys who, you know, no one really knows anything about. As Johnson's Law will, you know, says, the more obscure the person, the easier it is to lie about. The fewer the number of people who can refute the lies. And simply there's more ignorance. So making these kind of mistakes, even indeliberately, occurs all the time. Certainly much more commonly. This seems to be the pattern. And then after a while, once the person is dead, like Saddam Hussein or Gaddafi, something is released, a small news story comes out saying that we were wrong after all. But so what? These guys are dead. Americans are dead. Americans are broke. There's no legitimacy. You know, everything else. And these wars are admitted publicly by the regime as a whole to be a total failure, a total fraud. And now we have the same being said of Milosevic. Milosevic has been rendered innocent by people who never really understood him to begin with, of war crimes. Now, war crime really is a form of self-defense that is accomplished by someone who the New World Order doesn't like. That's what a war crime is. It has to do with what side you're on. Certainly has nothing to do with how many bodies are produced. I bring this up, I'm going to talk about this today, because it's not an obscure issue. Certainly isn't for me. But it's far more important than the garbage that's being rammed down the dumbed-down American throat every day in the press. Electoral politics is absolutely meaningless. Elected officials don't have power. If we had elections as to who ran CBS, I'd be very interested in voting. But until that happens, the window dressing is of no interest to me. Politicians don't have power. Banks have power. Corporations have power. Private capital controls the state. Private capital is more powerful than the state. The state depends on private capital to function. If you need private banks to forward you money so you could function, generally you're a lot weaker than the private banks would be. So Bernie Sanders used to talk about how he's going to regulate the banks. And I said, with what? Well, the banks regulate you. Unless you're talking about completely, you know, revolutionizing the government, shredding the Constitution, which under certain circumstances may not be a bad thing. I have no particular loyalty to it. The world of you know, the 1780s no longer exists. Those words in the Constitution aren't even understood anymore. But he is in no position to talk about regulating any private entity, now especially since most of the federal government is being privatized. So the distinction between public and private no longer exists in politics whatsoever. So much of this political nonsense has absolutely no value anyway, because you're not talking about a public sector that's worth discussing. There is no such thing. The exoneration of Milosevic is not an obscure issue. It only seems obscure because it's not on the front page. It's of immense importance. And his exoneration is one of a few very significant examples of how the regime will knowingly lie. And then when everything is over, tell you, kind of rub your face in it, saying, yeah, sorry, we were wrong, too bad, you know, we got what we wanted out of it. This is not maybe a concept of revelation of the method. Michael Hoffman taught us all about how 18th century Masonic texts speak of this notion that once they receive sufficient power, that they're comfortable admitting that they have this power. And if nothing happens to them as a result of their admission, that means their power is absolute. There's a psychological connection here that just creates a demoralized population. I thought that when the bailouts of the major banks occurred, both under Bush and Obama, that the U.S. citizenry did absolutely nothing. They had lost their homes. Millions and millions went bankrupt. So they're screwed over in that respect. And they're screwed over again in that more money is extracted from them to bail out the people who screwed them over in the first time. If nothing happened there, then nothing will happen. I need to be, it needs to be proven to me that the American population, American male, is going to stand up for much of anything. I think you guys need to realize that in terms of actual revolutionary politics, I've said this before, people talk a great game, but think for a minute. I know this is kind of off our subject, but think for a minute of what a revolutionary has to be. I'm talking about a revolutionary movement, a violent movement, overthrow a government. Anywhere in the world, it doesn't matter. Revolutionary mind, wherever you are, in any period in history, has to be the same. If you are going to take up that cause in America, like the communists have always claimed to want to do, to be a real revolutionary, you can't have any family. You cannot be married. You cannot have children. You cannot have those kind of ties. It's a huge area of leverage. Your independence will be compromised because you have those responsibilities. So a revolutionary can't be married, can't have children. He certainly can't have a job. He can't have a real identity. He can't have a normal place to live. He can't own anything. Because once his activity becomes known, that will be taken from him or used as a bargaining chip. He can't have any social standing at all. He can't have friends. He can't have any lasting social connections whatsoever. He can't have credit cards. He can't have a bank account. He can't get magazines delivered to his house. He can't have any of those things. He can't have any life at all and has to be willing to admit that he will probably be killed. So unless you're willing to do that, then don't talk to me about being a revolutionary and engaging in an armed insurrection. You see this with these the NRA people. They talk about how they're you'll pry my gun from my cold dead hands. I say no, you will sheepishly give your gun over, is what you're going to do. Because you know that to be a revolutionary, to take up arms against the state, you have to live that kind of a life. Or else you won't be successful. You have to be prepared for the regime to machine gun a bunch of little kids in the playground somewhere and have doctored pictures showing you doing it and convincing the world that you have just killed all these kids. They will do that, and people will believe that you did it. It's so easy to doctor that or just to convince people that that happened that way. But there's any evidence at all. There's no evidence that a plane hit the Pentagon, but everyone still thinks it. You have to be prepared for things like that to happen and spend the rest of your very short life with that hanging over your head. That's what a revolutionary has to do, a real revolutionary. Real revolutionaries don't run political campaigns, don't get positive press coverage, don't have paid campaign ads on television. A revolutionary is someone who wants to overthrow the state and remake the society, has to live precisely that kind of a life, or they can't be a revolutionary. So unless you're prepared for that, shut up with the tough guy talk. Okay? That's what a real revolutionary has to be. If you can't do that, then you have to deal with the proper way, the lawful means of going about changing things. The system right now wants nothing more than people on the right wing start shooting places up. They would love this. Chaos is important to the system. It makes people suggestible. And to depict nationalists as crazy, trigger-happy lunatics is in their interest, certainly. Because there is only one enemy, and that is nationalism. The Cold War was not about Marxism. The regime never had any problem with that, to the extent they even understood what it was. No, the only time the Soviet Union was ever a problem was when they acted like a separate nationalist body, creating their own trading bloc without the U.S., without the dollar. All of a sudden, then they became a problem. Before World War II, The only time people like Woodrow Wilson and others would condemn the Soviet Union is if they were behaving too much like the Tsars were, like Russian nationalists. This was the only time the Soviet Union was a problem. So we take all this together and this long introduction here. Conclude it, you say, number one, what's being fed every day in the press, these issues, these campaigns, this is mostly just smoke and mirrors. It's utter nonsense. None of this stuff matters. Politicians don't have power. And once they take office, they won't be able to make good on any of these promises anyway. And yet every year, people trust them, and every year, people give them money. Number two, the real issues, of course, are not being discussed because they can't. The real issues simply are too difficult and complicated. Politics now has nothing to do with empowerment or freedoms or anything like that. The average American has no idea what to do with freedom, has no clue whatsoever. They think freedom is the absence of external restraint. So my cat is free when it goes chasing after a mouse, according to that definition. They're in no position to even know what to do with freedom. It's not about that. It's about entertainment. It's like a football game. That's what politics is. Number three, as things get worse and worse in this country, you're going to have more and more irrational responses. And the system is going to go very far in trying to promote that, to get rid of those who it threatens, those people who threaten it, and make their enemy, the only enemy they have, which is the nationalists, people like us, look as insane as possible. And I've said here, you wanted to take that revolutionary route. That's the kind of life you have no choice but to lead. And you will be miserable, and you will probably be killed, but that's what a revolutionary has to do. And finally, and I think most importantly, the regime is in the process of starting a war with both Russia and China. This is not being discussed at any convention. It's not, when Pokemon and Donald Trump's wife are front page news while the U.S. has combat troops in an offensive position on the Russian border. It shows you that all of this is a fraud. Politics is a fraud. Liberal democracy is a fraud. Corporate America is a fraud. None of it. It's nothing but images, smoke, and mirrors. The reality behind it is something completely different. So, that being said, we talk about one of these issues that is not being discussed. Small issue, small article that I saw, I can't even remember the news source now, that Slobodan Milosevic has been exonerated by The Hague, the so-called World Court, which actually is under NATO control, of all war crime. And it makes a lot of sense that they would release that information now because no one cares. They release that information now because it's a tremendous substance and has great implications, which most people are not capable of drawing out. It means that it's all a lie. It's an admission that these kind of adventures abroad have nothing to do with the stated goals. They are completely economic. And you talk about a place with Somalia or Yugoslavia, the average intellectual, the average journalist, the average person who follows foreign affairs generally has no idea what's going on. They're completely at the mercy of the press. I might want to note also, as an aside, I've read, and I haven't written about this yet, but I've read Russian intelligence reports from the early 1990s talking about American casualty. I may have mentioned this before, I can't remember if I did or not, that American casualties in the first Iraq war were extremely high. It didn't make any sense to me, even at the time I was in college. It made no sense to me that the Iraqi air defense system, which was extremely sophisticated, which was installed, supplied by the Soviet Union, their crews were trained by it, that they were so incompetent that there were hardly any casualties in the air. I found it very bizarre that this huge army, on their home turf, would simply dissolve when the U.S. landed. It was not absolutely certain that the U.S. was going to win. They had everything against them. Why would they dissolve? When they were training for this. They knew how to handle this sort of thing. They had many elite units. Nothing seemed to happen. There were a few engagements. The West was essentially saying, I remember it quite well, that there were minimal casualties, a handful of casualties. Well, Russian military intelligence says differently. Hundreds of American aircraft were blown out of the sky. This has been covered up, of all sorts, fighters, bombers, reconnaissance, everything. Which, of course, makes sense, given the nature of the air defenses that they had. Hundreds and hundreds of American planes were shot out of the sky. American ground casualties were extremely high, minimum of 10,000 deaths. Just in the first Iraq War. And they're able to demonstrate this with the number of death benefits that have been paid out by the Pentagon. And other things that prove that the Pentagon is paying out and doing things that suggest large numbers of deaths. The casualties were very high. No one questioned the numbers. No one asked the simple question as to why this fairly sophisticated army, well-equipped, well-trained, on their home turf, would simply run away because a few hundred thousand Americans show up. Very few of them having any combat experience whatsoever. It didn't make any sense. And as always, if it doesn't make any sense, it's not true. So in that vein, though, I wanted to talk about Yugoslavia under Milosevic. Just because it's not on the front page doesn't mean it's not important. It's of immense importance. And the reason I bring this up is not just because Milosevic has been exonerated, which is a huge admission from the regime. It's a big deal, even though it hasn't been reported anything more than a few lines. But also the way that Yugoslavia was destroyed is extremely important. It was a method that was a test case, both military action against Yugoslavia and the economic destruction of the country was an experiment, how the international banking cartel can be used to destroy a country. Remember, Yugoslavia was a Marxist state, sort of. It was not a tyranny. There's certainly nothing like Stalin's Soviet Union, nothing like that whatsoever. The form of socialism in Yugoslavia actually had quite a bit going for it. And in the 50s and 60s, Yugoslavia was registering double-digit growth. They were essentially a first world, so to speak, a first world economy by 1970. And the system was based on something called self-management. I was a thesis advisor when I was at Mount St. Mary's to someone who did their thesis on this. Since I'm the only one who knew anything about it, I was her thesis chairman, and I'm very happy I did it. When people learn about this stuff for the first time, they say, "How come I've never heard of this before?" It was not communism in any kind of Leninist sense. It was highly decentralized. It was very representative. The only real big problem was, of course, the ethnic issue and, bizarrely enough, the attack on religion, which, you know, doesn't seem to have any intrinsic connection to socialism. There's certainly plenty of Christian socialists out there. I'm one of them. Socialism before Marx was far more idealistic and certainly very religious prior to Marx. It was Marx and the Rothschild family that turned it into this atheistic cabal. But even in that department, the church was not nearly persecuted the way it was in the USSR. Self-management simply organized this way. Number one, you had the commune, which was a non-economic political unit. It raised its own funds. It took care of basic social service. Most of the positions there were elected. This was the basic unit of government that everyone dealt with on a regular basis. The parallel structure there was in the economy. Workers' councils in any given industry, in the sector, as well as in the individual firm. This is where the Titoist system really should be taken very seriously. It worked. It worked for a while. It turned Yugoslavia from third world to a first world country in a generation. Without a lot of the problems of extreme inequality that statist capitalism has a tendency to create. The workers' council at the firm level, at the company level, was an elected body where workers, management, white collar, blue collar, took their positions on this committee. And really, there's seven areas that the Workers' Council was focused on. Number one, they manage the day-to-day affairs of the factory in terms of its in terms of basic structure and the division of labor. Number two, they plan the production methods. They actually laid out in detail how things were to be done. Number three, they distributed all the firm's income, accounts receivable and accounts payable. Number four, they took care of all human resources. They hired, they fired, they promoted. Number five, all business matters, especially the relationships to the commune and to the state in general. Police regulatory work was handled by this council. Number six, all profits were distributed by the council. And finally, the relationship as, well, more abstractly, they were ideological body, that they maintained the socialist idea at the firm level. That was the weakest of all of their jobs, but that actually became a big problem because pragmatism and ideology was always clashing. Now, this system worked. While Tito was not elected, companies that actually produce things that you spent most of your life working for, these did have elected bodies running things. Profits, income, accounts payable, all of these were decided on by the Workers' Council. This was elected. This had a lot of turnover. In fact, Tito even went so far as to ban all kinds of the technocratic domination, where it's the same people getting elected every few years. He needed to stop that. That's a very common thing in these councils. The same guys would show up again and again, more interested in power than anything else. Turnover actually was impressive. If you were there long enough, everyone ended up serving on this council. And this is how the system ran. This is not Soviet socialism. To a great extent, this has more to do with a pre-modern form of socialism than the Leninist variety. The Leninist variety of socialism had nothing to do with labor. I've said that on this program before. I said it in writing. I will continue to say it. Tito actually was the only socialist at the time who worried about workers. It was extremely rare for Lenin or Stalin or Trotsky or Khrushchev to do anything that improved a lot of labor. They were a tool that the party used. They were exploited beyond belief. The Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact had nothing to do with labor. It simply was this instrument where the fruits of the labor of the population were transmitted to the party. That's all it ever was. Ideology was irrelevant. You could point to nothing in their history that improved in any substantial way or any sustained way the lot of labor. They were always seen as a tool of the dictator. But with Tito, you actually have a care for labor. He was a freak in the socialist world. It was almost as if the Soviets were saying, what is all this worker stuff? That's not what socialism is. And for very good reason, Yugoslavia has always been kind of this black spot, even among socialists, that no one knows how the society ran. And yet it did become a first world country in a fairly short period of time. Now, the ethnic issue was always a huge problem, and it took a very powerful central figure, one that had enough power to purge the regional bodies of people who were, and the other big issue was centralization versus decentralization. Tito had rejected both extremes. He saw decentralization as just an imitation for these people creating these mini empires for themselves, carving out their own little fiefs and using ethnicity as a way to separate from the rest of the society. On the other hand, centralization took away from the concept of self-management. Self-management became a part of the society, not just the economy. Tito's mentality was to have, he didn't have plans in the Soviet sense. These were very flexible. They gave the general outline of what they might want to see happen. But how this was to be carried out was a job of the Workers' Council. That there was simply a flexibility there By the early 1970s, he needed to purge the regional party bosses. He is always concerned with the notion of this technocratic domination. People who don't care about political theory, who don't care about the nation, who don't care about democracy or representation or freedom. People who just are obsessed with efficiency and getting things done without questioning why it should be done or how it should be done. They have no real loyalty. They're simply functionaries. And they live and breathe the administration and the mechanistic mentality of the bureaucracy. Unfortunately, these people are necessary for any society to function. You need functionaries. But giving them power is another matter. And Tito and the notion of self-management was constantly at war with the technocracy, so to speak, which in many ways often includes bankers, loathed the idea of self-management. Now, the tragic ending to all of this, and one of the main points I'm trying to make here, is the means by which the IMF, the globalist New World Order, so to speak, the very beginning of its victory, you know, over this irritating Soviet Union, how they went about experimenting with destroying a society. The destruction of Yugoslavia, for better or for worse, was absolutely essential for the New World Order to come to understand what their rule in the post-Soviet world is going to be like. Now, let me make something clear. I've used the word regime many times. Usually in political discussions, one of the ways that you could tell an amateur from a knowledgeable person is that they often don't define their terms. They use words equivocally, and they don't understand sometimes that words like regime are actually technical terms rather than just an epithet. You either could use a word like that in its normal technical usage, or at least define it in context. And the way I'm using the word regime, normally regime is just any institution. That's what concept of regime is, kind of a regularity in political life, a ritual, so to speak. That's the technical definition of what a regime is. I'm using it, though, with a capital R. When I say the word regime, I'm referring to the very unorganized and yet highly efficient way that the New World Order function. You're talking about the government, academics, journalists, these activist groups on the street, politicians, technocrats, bankers. Of course, they're not all equal. But they all have their role to play. They're different sectors of the economy. They have different worlds. But they all owe their existence to this overarching globalized banking system. So the regime is this public-private form of power and control. It's far superior to the old Soviet system where you had, you know, gulags and secret policemen. The regime uses as much private sector power as state power. State power is really not the problem in America. I never believed that the state is really all that fearsome. It's private sector power that matters. They're more powerful than the state, and they're not under the same rules. Remember, the Constitution of the U.S. governs only the federal government. You know, unfortunately, it doesn't govern CBS and Goldman Sachs that are a heck of a lot more powerful than the federal government. And as these corporations are given the status of legal persons, fictitious persons, that means all the freedoms and rights of association and speech are granted to these immensely powerful entities, thereby completely undercutting the actual purpose of the Constitution. The Constitution was meant to create gridlock, where the branches of government, caring only about their own careers and self-interest, will end up clashing, and so nothing will get done, or very little will get done. That's the point of the Constitution. Let the government fight each other, so they're not bothering us, to put it very simply. That's been undercut by the fact that massive private sector forms of power have come into existence that in no way the founding generation could ever have understood. With institutions like the British East India Company and things like that, but to have this network of conglomerates is something completely new. That's very important. When I say the New World Order, I mean the exact same thing as globalization. And what I mean is this economic drive to destroy all borders so as to lower transaction costs in terms of trade. Having no borders, having no different currencies, having no different, this one world system will reduce all wages and prices to the lowest possible level, increasing profits for those who control capital, but reducing the rest of the world to a completely identityless mass that's also very poor. That's the purpose, and that's what it is. So regime is simply how the New World Order functions. Now, how it functions is manifest in this destruction of Yugoslavia. It was a test case, and how the regime functions in every other place, even the U.S. included, and the post-Soviet world had its start in Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia was a fairly successful society by the late 1980s. But a lot of problems, not quite as bad as in the West, but a lot of problems were developing. The regional issue, a new generation was coming to power, didn't have the patience for the old Titoite idea. The rise of technocracy, especially those connected with foreign trade, and ethnic nationalism in certain places, with that really very kind of ridiculous mix of people who often have nothing in common, held together only by Tito. Tito dies in 1980. The succession was never well taken care of. And so these issues, including trade deficit and increasing debt, slowed, not to mention the oil shocks of the 70s, slowed Yugoslav growth by the early 1980s. They had no choice but to bring in the IMF. The International Monetary Fund is not an institution. It's simply a consortium of bankers. It's just a consortium of bankers, you know, using a different placard to identify themselves. That's all it is. And nothing will happen there that's not in the interests of bankers. Those bankers are more powerful than governments, so they do not represent governments, despite the fact they may have a flag attached to their voting booth. The IMF immediately, and for the first time in the post-Soviet world, imposed austerity on Yugoslavia. They came in with a lot of money, a lot of Western knowledge. The Soviet Union was in the process of collapsing. They were listened to. They were seen as wizards. The Soviet Union was collapsing. A lot of Yugoslavs were very happy about that. And these guys come in with a ton of money, promising Yugoslavia the prosperity of the West, but that wasn't in that wasn't on the agenda. Liquidating the economy to pay debts, that was on the agenda. That's what happened in Ukraine in 2013-14. It was to bring in a pro-Western government so as to then, with an authoritarian system, sell off all functional assets to pay debt and then to keep the country poor and simply an agricultural supplier to Europe. 1990, industrial production fell 10%. GDP fell 8%. The IMF demanded that the public sector be dismantled. The first thing the IMF said, if you want this loan from us, get rid of self-management. They hated it. They didn't quite understand it. But they said, this is the first thing they said has to go. It clearly was a threat to them. They deliberately fueled dissent, especially when, as the economy is contracting, money from the center is contracting. The power that emanates from Belgrade is contracting. There's going to be a lot of local powers that are going to start fighting each other to take over what's left. Tito is gone. The king has been killed. Then his descendants will fight it out. Ronald Reagan said, bringing Yugoslavia to democracy and overthrowing Tito or Titoism is identical to inserting Yugoslavia into world markets. That was the explicit understanding of what overthrowing Marxism was, including this sort of Marxism, which they actually didn't understand whatsoever. What market reform was in the IMF's mind and how it was imposed on Yugoslavia was forcing all capital that wasn't liquidated to shift its production to things of interest to the West. It was a way to outsource some Western jobs to a well-educated but lower-wage society. Everything was shifted towards producing not for themselves, but bits and pieces of a much larger systemic economy to like Yugoslavia, you know, or like Ukraine, to be this deindustrialized agricultural producer. You know, they wanted Yugoslavia to be essentially a minerals producer. Again, deindustrialized. Most of this industry had been liquidated as the economy started to collapse, and there was no public sector to save it, and there was no self-management to help organize it as it got worse and worse. This is one thing that self-management could have done very well. Liberalization was defined in this era in Yugoslavia as destroying self-management. Destroying self-management meant that these workers' councils had to go, but it also meant that all power was to be centralized. They had no interest in representation. They only cared about having as much power as quickly as possible, so as to go after these profitable businesses before the owners, the workers, got gist of what's going on. In Ukraine, they took up arms before they could be liquidated. That's the entire point of the civil war in eastern Ukraine. In Yugoslavia, they didn't have the chance. They moved far more quickly, and they didn't fully understand what the IMF wanted. It wasn't very clear what was happening, especially in the times of confusion of the fall of the Soviet Union. It should be noted that the man who wrote the austerity program and the so-called reform program for Yugoslavia in 1990 was no other than Jeffrey Sachs, of the famous Goldman Sachs banking firm. So banking had been centralized under foreign control in Belgrade. Self-management was completely destroyed. The commune was gone. Everything tightly, at least economic power, was tightly centralized, and the ethnic groups were encouraged to take more power for themselves. They could make a separate deal with the West. They could go to the IMF saying, we'll dismantle everything, just make sure we're taken care of, we have our own our little fief that you guys can protect for us, and we'll do whatever you want. Guys who are only used to bureaucratic positions don't really know how to wheel and deal in the Western sense. They were in way over their heads. Any new company created there was automatically owned by the West. It's the same thing today in Ukraine, where any profits made by any functional firm whatsoever in Ukraine automatically belong to Ukraine's creditors. So if you're a Ukrainian worker, why are you going to work? Nothing that you do is going to stay there. And you know that there really is no point showing up to work, because at any moment, if you have a well-run factory, it will be liquidated and shipped abroad. The point is that eventually what is left, what capital is left that hasn't been worn out, that hasn't been antiquated, they'll get every little bit of value they can out of it and then liquidate it and sell it off. So by the time all the assets were stripped, local government is destroyed, social services are gone, the commune is gone, self-management is gone, and everything is centralized. At least the finance is centralized in Belgrade. There is no national sovereignty left anymore. Hyperinflation kicks in, and the economy completely collapses. This is how it was meant to go, and it was a huge success for the IMF and for the globalists. This is how they will then deal with every other country that they need to work with. Now, unfortunately, not every country is going to be as easy as Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia had enough divisions that the IMF can play one region against another with no problem. That's harder to do elsewhere, like in Libya. There was no strong central government in Belgrade like there was under Tito. You couldn't, someone like Gaddafi could, under different circumstances, have been a locus of resistance. There was nothing like that in Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia had a fairly advanced economy, increasingly dependent on foreign trade, and have a tremendous amount of debt that also was used. Plus the fact that you're talking about a time before the Soviet Union shocked everyone, and so now everybody in that part of the world is questioning the basic Marxist or statist ideology that they had been brought up with. The chaos of the era made people there very easy to deal with. The Soviet Union is imploding which really should have been a vindication of Yugoslavia. And Yugoslavia had received Western aid in the past so as to keep them away from joining the trade bloc of the USSR. But there was still tremendous debt, not only just in terms of the economy, but also in terms of previous aid and assistance from the United States. There was always this fear of collapse, and Tito even permitted there to be caches of weapons were hidden all over the country so that the militia can, if they're under occupation, they know where they are. In the middle of the night, they can go and empty the magazine and take action. So when the Civil War broke out in the early 90s, the first thing that hit me was these caches are known to certain members of the elite. And, of course, that's one of the reasons it got, in certain places, got very bloody. When I talk about the issue of Yugoslavia, which seems kind of out of place today, but now you realize that it's not. This is the issue that everyone should be talking about. Not Yugoslavia necessarily, but the methods by which Jeff Sachs here, the writer of this, the man who actually, you know, had his people write this reform bill, how to recreate Yugoslav society, how to simply destroy it, walking in with a lot of money and a lot of promises. Once you got these guys on the hook, and they didn't need help at the time, you begin making demands and more demands and more demands. You threaten them with regional differences. You go to one faction and use them against another, Croats versus Serbs, whatever it was. And it's very easy, especially given the time period, especially given the confusion of the time period, to have this go very smoothly. Asset stripping ultimately was the goal. It was not production. Asset stripping is to take any profitable, productive area of production of capital and liquidate it. Liquidate it and send it to the bank accounts outside of the country. That's what's been done in Russia in the early 90s at this very same time, and is the cause of the civil war in Ukraine today. That the labor of these people, sometimes under very harsh circumstances, is treated with complete disdain by these elites, and is being liquidated all over the world. And really, you know, the debt isn't really dealt with at all with this kind of money. It goes into the pockets of those who are doing the asset stripping, both local and foreign. And the locals are in no position to do much of anything without foreign money. Remember, oligarchy in different parts of Eastern Europe exists because they're sponsored by the U.S., because they have the protection, diplomatic and financial, of the U.S. This is why the IMF can, you know, loan money to Kiev, knowing that they'll never see that money again, knowing that there is no rationality in the economy, and there is no economy. It is possible to simply strip a country so bare that there is no production going on that isn't private, isn't foreign owned. Yugoslavia, middle of the 1990s, had collapsed completely. And then once the IMF, the globalist movement, the regime, had taken everything that they could have, once the regime completely destroyed self-management at all levels, took all profitable industries, started a war amongst the regions, they then very piously sat back and said, we stand for self-determination of the different ethnic groups in Yugoslavia. And the time for the end of Yugoslavia, I think, is here. They were piously intone that we're interested in this. You know, now I think they should be independent. After they've created the conditions for this, they've created the animosity, they've destroyed the economy, and now they sit back and act like they are apostles of self-determination. And that's the arrogance, that's the nastiness, the viciousness of the regime, and why I've dedicated myself to making it look as absurd as possible. And that's what I do here. That's what the Orthodox Nationalist is. And with that, I ask you to turn off the damn television. Don't worry about Donald Trump's wife or this Pokemon crap, and read some history. Thank you. I'll talk to you next time.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.